It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. So where do those aha moments of culinary discovery come from? For Chef Sean Brock, who's famous for reviving lost flavors of the South, sometimes it's a combo of disappointment and stubborn curiosity.
I had the lesson of my life over a bowl of Hoppin' John, and I didn't even know it was happening. It was in the late 90s, and I was in culinary school, and I'd read so much about this dish from these old 19th century books, and I just kept seeing Hoppin' John everywhere. And my first experience eating Hoppin' John wasn't the greatest. It took years and years and years for me to figure out why exactly that happened. And that's because the products weren't available. The rice wasn't available, the peas weren't available.
Sean Brock on the true flavors of the South. And 2014 is a rough year for Italian olive oil. This hour on The Splendid Table. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This holiday season, we're partnering with Feeding America to bring help to people who are hungry. Hunger happens in every community, rural or urban, and it impacts all of us. When you support The Splendid Table now, your gift will help provide meals to people in need through our partners at Feeding America and their network of local member food banks. Learn how to help at splendidtable.org/give. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It was pork fat that brought Chef Sean Brock and me together. It was in Nashville. A hotel chef was assigned my 6-course meal of pork fat dishes, part of the presentation for a group of pork scientists. Now, hotel cooks usually don't thrill to these oddball assignments, but I lucked out with Sean Brock, a chef in love with challenges and tastes of the past. The lunch took off. Well, later Sean told me about growing up in a coal town in rural Virginia, a town where if you weren't eating what you grew and raised, you were preserving what you grew and raised. Well, those sensibilities now thrive in his award-winning southern restaurants, Husk and McCrady's. He serves low-country cooking that brings back lost tastes and ingredients. And not surprisingly, his first book is called Heritage. Contributor Noel Carter talked to Sean about his path.
Sean, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You mentioned early in the book that your mission is to elevate southern food, and the first recipe you give is for Hoppin' John. But this isn't just any recipe. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, I had the lesson of my life over a bowl of Hoppin' John, and I didn't even know it was happening. It was in the late 90s, and I was in Charleston attending culinary school, and I'd read so much about this dish. And I was reading so much about low country cooking from these old 19th century books, and I just kept seeing Hoppin' John everywhere. And my first experience eating Hoppin' John wasn't the greatest. It really tasted very, very bland. And it took years and years and years for me to figure out why exactly that happened. And that's because the products weren't available. The rice wasn't available. The peas weren't available.
It is all about the ingredients. And you make a big point in the book about talking about preserving heritage ingredients and searching out kind of lost foods and the lost ingredients that made them.
Yeah, you know, I was reading a lot about the food of the South, sort of pre-Civil War, and I was kind of fascinated with that. A lot of things changed after the Civil War in agriculture and therefore cooking, but a lot of the cuisine's foundation was built in that antebellum period. And the products that were being grown were just extraordinary. The soil they were being grown in was amazing, but the exact varietals themselves had a very, very amazing flavor. And after the Civil War, a lot of that stuff, and then going into the Great Depression, a lot of that stuff just kind of disappeared, and so the flavor disappears. And so for us, it's very, very important to find those old varieties and bring back that flavor, and that's, in our minds, the only way that you can truly restore a cuisine.
Now, you describe yourself as an obsessive seed collector, and a number of the ingredients you use were perhaps on the verge of extinction. I know you've done a lot of work with Glenn Roberts of Anson Mills and others to preserve and promote heirloom crops. Can you talk a little about this?
Yeah, you know, well, it was a way of living for my grandmother and for my family, as you just saved these seeds, not because you were poor, because you really loved the flavor of a particular tomato or a particular bean. And like I said, that just kind of became a part of me my whole life. And then after meeting Glenn and John at Blackberry Farm, I really saw the importance of it, because if we're not saving these things, then they're going to disappear. And when they disappear, the stories disappear, the flavor disappears. And it's just, once you realize that, you do everything you can to keep that from happening. And the more you do it, the more beautiful food you find. And it's like, I'm a collector. I collect guitars. I collect all kinds of different things. So it's another way for me to feed that obsession. And I've been collecting seeds for as long as I can remember.
Right. One of the things I got from your book was, as much as you talk about Southern food, your philosophy and your passion can be applied to, you know, almost any regional cuisine.
Yeah, I think each place has its own taste, and that's just a fascinating thing to think about. And that's important for a chef, and that's important for someone with a restaurant, because when people visit you, when they come to Nashville or when they come to Charleston or wherever your restaurant is, you know, that's another extension of that visit. That's the way a place tastes. That's what it feels like to eat. That's the emotion that comes along with visiting a place is that experience at the dinner table. And in order to do that, you've really got to focus on collecting the ingredients and the recipes and the stories of each region, no matter what region that is. You know, it's not really about geography. It's just about an attitude.
I have one last question. Is there a recipe in the book that best encapsulates your philosophy?
You know, I've been thinking a lot about what my favorite thing in that book is, and it's kind of a hidden recipe. It's not laid out like a traditional recipe. It's kind of a story, and it's kind of the way old recipes used to be written and passed down, and that's this recipe for my grandmother's mixed pickles. Like, you literally take a crock, a huge creek rock, and a pillow, and some vegetables, and some salt and water. You blanch them, and then you put them into this crock in this salt water solution. You put the rock in the pillowcase, and you drop that on top to weight it down, and you let that ferment for as long as you want. But to me, like, you rarely see those kind of recipes. You rarely see that recipe. It's corn and beans and cabbage and peppers, and it's just amazing. It was always on the table when I was a kid, and for me, I just love introducing those new things to people and then watching them get hooked and like, wow, I can't believe I've never had those mixed pickles. And now I have them every day. And to me, that's one of the great things about being able to write a book, is to share those things from your childhood. I was very, very lucky to have grown up in a family that loves food more than I've ever seen anybody love food. Just the passion that my mother and my grandmother had as a child, watching them, you know, marvel over a tomato was something that I find myself doing every day now, and it's just amazing how hereditary that is.
It's a beautiful thing. Sean, thank you so much for your time, and I can't wait to try every single recipe in your cookbook.
Thank you very much. I hope you like them.
Sean Brock is author of Heritage. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Well, Sean left us with a Southern holiday menu that includes Hoppin' John, a good opportunity to get to know your ingredients. And you can find it at splendidtable.org. Michael Stern are always on the lookout for survivors, the hometown places that still thrive in spite of the chains. They keep track of them on their website, roadfood.com, and they come by here to tell all. Jane, Michael, welcome back.
Great to be here, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
So what's the latest find?
We have a very weird place to tell you about. It's called Bobke's Bread Basket, and it's a German bakery and German restaurant. Now, you know, there's many German-American restaurants in the country. What's weird about this place is it's in Sierra Vista, Arizona, which is really in the desert. It's the most southwestern part of Arizona, near Douglas. And, every other place to eat is Mexican or American. But this is the most wonderful German bakery. It's been there a long time, and truly everything on the menu is homemade, handmade, and delicious.
Is this a case where a family just settled there?
Well, there is a reason. Sierra Vista is home of Fort Huachaca. It's a military base that attracts people, you know, people from all over the world come there. So, in fact, Sierra Vista has a lot of interesting restaurants with cuisines of the world. What's great about Bobke's is it's the real deal. I mean, the staff at Bobke's, even though it's been there for 23 years, all speak German among each other. And the repertoire of baked goods is absolutely out of this world. They have the best looking, the handsomest pound cakes and also most delicious pound cakes I have ever seen.
And so is it a place where you can sit and actually eat, or do you?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
There are booths, and there's also a bakery counter up front where, as Michael said, you can get this phenomenal made-from-scratch pound cake, stollen strudels, sort of German cookie and bar. You can get pretzel rolls. You can get macaroons. I grew up near Yorkville in Manhattan, and, you know, I kind of think I know what good German-American baking is like. I haven't had anything this good since back in the ye old days when I used to wear knee socks and Mary Janes and go to 86th Street and go to Yorkville.
Yes. Before our baked goods, we sat down for a really nice plate of Wiener Schnitzel and Spätzle.
Oh, and with German potato salad.
With German potato salad and a really good bratwurst sandwich. I mean, it's a limited menu. It's not a grand German menu. I don't think they have sauerbraten and pig's knuckles and all that stuff. But it's a nice little German menu, very informal, very inexpensive. And I have to tell you, one of the great things about this place is that we were on our way to Bisbee, Arizona when we stopped there. Bisbee is a town that has many, many wonderful things about it. But one of them is it has some great coffee roasters.
Uh-huh.
So what we did, we brought a bunch of cakes, cookies, and pastries with us from Sierra Vista to Bisbee. And boy, it was a perfect combination because we had great coffee in Bisbee along with all these great German baked goods to eat with it.
I'm picturing your back seat covered with crumbs.
It always
wrinkles
is.
Coffee
always.
Cups
it always
on the floor.
Is. And Lynn, have you bought a big pound cake at a bakery recently?
No, I haven't.
Okay. I have, and they're like $35. I mean, they're incredibly expensive. This pound cake, it was under $10, and it was big enough for a family of 15.
Well, it lasted for the next 3, 4, 5 days of our trip.
Which is saying something, considering we never stopped eating it.
Right.
A good pound cake? I'd walk quite a distance to get a really good pound cake.
It's hard to find one.
Thank you, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Jane and Michael Stern are the founders of RoadFood.com. Find their picks on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, you're going to find that the site is packed with opportunities. Browse our recipe box, check out books and other offerings from our guests, download our podcasts, and get registered for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Now, we're turning 20 in 2015, and we're going to be sending out a series of special collections throughout the year to commemorate. The plotting is underway, so get registered, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the artistic link between food and gratitude. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. So much of the winter holidays are about hospitality, generosity, thankfulness, and yes, food, which leads us to art. David Legar is an American contemporary realist painter whose work has been shown all over the world. Well, he's created 5 exhibits that focus on food, specifically on the relationship between food and gratitude. Our contributor, Rebecca Shear, recently spoke with Legar about what he sees as an entirely new genre of art.
Well, David Legar, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you.
Now let's talk about the history of food as an offering, because I know you say it goes back to ancient times with religious rites. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, I have been making still life paintings for many, many years, and I was looking at some ancient paintings from ancient Rome, actually, or ancient Pompeii, and thinking that there were aspects of these that seemed like they weren't what they were supposed to be. That is, oftentimes they were called xenia paintings. And xenia, that's spelled X-E-N-I-A, but xenia were food gifts for strangers. When people came to your house as guests, they would be given a meal with the family on the first night that they were there, and then always after that, they were given a basket of food that they ate in their own quarters, presumably prepared by their own servants, I would guess. And in any case, so many of the ancient still life paintings were thought to be these xenia. Now, when I was traveling in Nepal about 10 years ago or so, I noticed that there were these shrines along the road that oftentimes had various fruits and rice and flowers and so on them, and that there would be chickens pecking at this or birds pecking at these things, and they looked so much like the ancient still life paintings that I had seen in Pompeii and Herculaneum, and I just thought, this is I think what these are. And I began studying about ancient Greek religion, which I hadn't studied about before, and discovered that there was a category of ritual called aparkai, and that was the ritual of the offering of the first fruits of the season, and discovered also that there were depictions of these that could sometimes be left at the altar in lieu of the actual fruits themselves. So there is record of there being these paintings, but you know, we have almost no actual paintings from ancient Greece and very, very few from ancient Rome, and there were thousands.
You mentioned the word xenia, and one of your paintings is subtitled xenia. Can you describe it for us?
Yes. This idea of this food gift for strangers I thought was a really interesting one, and I used to do volunteering in a soup kitchen in Salinas, California, and one of the things that we served a lot was grape juice, and another thing were sandwiches. And so I made a painting of grape juice and sandwiches, which was literally a xenia. It was a food gift for strangers, for guests. And so it was a representation of the kind of food that was served in the soup kitchen. And afterwards, I made photographs of the grape juice and the sandwiches, and then brought them down to the kitchen, and they were consumed so that it was a kind of a loop, as it were. And that painting itself is in the museum in San Francisco, the De Young Museum. The painting of these paintings is itself a kind of a ritual. Mm. It's a kind of an exercise in mindfulness, that kind of concentration, either cooking or painting something, looking at it and thinking about it so carefully and everything that it can possibly be, and then creating this thing. And I think that it really is an act of thanksgiving, no matter when it is.
Well, David Lagar, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
For more information on David Lagar's projects, head to the website splendidtable.org. Rebecca Shear is host of Metro Connection at WAMU in Washington, D.C. The high season of eating is upon us, and new ideas are always welcome, especially ones that are going to save us time. Now, in that spirit, I've invited my partner in crime, producer Sally Swift, to join me here in the studio so we can talk about some quick and easy ideas for the holidays. So, Sally, why don't we start with appetizers?
I'd love to. You know, I have a little bit of a axe to grind with appetizers. You know, you've heard me lecture on this before, but
yes.
People feel like they have to give so much for an appetizer. I mean, an appetizer is meant to whet our appetites, right? Not fulfill us. So in that spirit, I just want to remind everyone that smaller can be better. And simple things work really, really well. A nice, beautiful bowl of sweet and salty nuts, maybe with a little spice added to them. I love pickled vegetables. You know, the kitchen had a great idea for kind of a modern relish tray that they did with all pickled vegetables, which I think feels really fresh and new. And I have just recently been pickling mushrooms, which I absolutely love. Those beautiful enoki mushrooms, they look almost like they're from a fairy tale. They are the most beautiful things. And I make a very, very simple brine with vinegar, salt, sugar, water. I add a little lemongrass and I crush black pepper so that you get these big chunks of black pepper with every little bite of those sweet, gorgeous little mushrooms. And they're delicious. And I've been eating them a bit obsessively, I have to admit, on Triscuits smeared with a little bit of cream cheese, and it is just delicious.
You know what's great, too, which I think people don't think of, is pickle fruit, because it's a wonderful contrast, sweet, tart, and great with drinks, like cubes of melon. Grapes are fabulous pickled.
Yeah, and they do grapes in the South often. I think that's a great one.
Yeah, and
they're tricky, too. They look like olives, so you're kind of fooling people.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. You know, one strategy that I really have found helps a lot is, wherever possible, buy pre-cut vegetables. Butternut squash you can now buy in cubes, and sweet potatoes. You take that butternut squash, you toss it with a little olive oil, allspice, black pepper, lemon, brown sugar, and slow roast it for maybe an hour. Do that a day or two ahead. Serve it on picks at room temperature.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
You know, the idea of having things at room temperature. Europeans do this all the time. They serve a ton of things at room temperature. And in fact, many, many things taste better at that temperature than they do when they're piping hot. Almost any vegetable that you roast is wonderful served room temperature. You, Lynn, have a recipe that I love for that red cabbage and apples glazed with mustard.
Yeah, and that's a delicious, it's a sort of almost a sweet sour treatment of the cabbage. It's inexpensive to do, and you do it a day ahead. You serve it at room temp, and it's just great. You know, the other thing I think people don't realize is that there are so many baked things that are really good, main courses, I mean, that are really good at room temperature. There's this really fabulous-looking crispy feta-stuffed phyllo tort. It's done in a bundt pan. It is a celebration. And, yeah, it takes a little work. But the reality is you do that work early in the day or the day before, and it's just wonderful. People think you have spent hours in the kitchen.
It is gorgeous. It's called Crispy Feta Stuffed Phyllo Tort. And you know who we got that idea from? It was Melissa Clark from the New York Times.
Right,
that
right.
is a party dish. And you drizzle each piece with a little drizzle of honey. It really is magnificent.
I love it.
So, Lynn, a lot of people are probably still struggling with what they're going to do for their big holiday meals. Do you have any ideas?
Well, you know, one of the ideas I love is there's a leg of lamb that you roast really slowly with honey and spices. And then every place you have Moroccan spices. So you have little dishes or little piles of different spice, and you have lettuce leaves. And what people do is they take the sliced lamb, they spice it the way they want it, they roll it up in the lettuce, and they have a very simple sauce that's fresh made, and everybody feasts.
Well, that's certainly non-traditional for the holidays.
No, Christmas, right? But the reality is it's a wonderful meal. It takes a long time to eat it. Everybody's engaged. And to accompany it, do grilled portobello mushrooms topped with a garlic and arugula topping. And that will be great for people who prefer not to eat meat. And then you can have side dishes if you want.
And what about, tell me one pasta that you would do for a group.
Oh, there's just no question what it would be. It is the simplest and most luxurious pasta I can serve. And it's perfect for the holidays, like Christmas Eve. Fettuccine Alfredo. The true fettuccine Alfredo.
I was going to say, what is the true fettuccine Alfredo?
I will not do my half-hour diatribe on the fact that there is no such thing as an Alfredo sauce. This is what fettuccine Alfredo is. You boil the pasta. You have a big pan. You melt a stick of butter for every pound of pasta. Put the hot pasta right into that melted butter. Toss it with a ton of Parmesan cheese, ground black pepper, a bit of salt, and you are done. That's it. No cream, because the Italians will, well, ask you never to come back. But the point is, that's it. And it is so fabulous, you will not believe it.
Delicious, and what a fun family supper.
Absolutely.
And the other thing that's become a total tradition in my house is I make this gnocchi with ricotta cheese that is so kid-friendly. My daughter started making it with me when she was about 6 years old, and the dough is so malleable. It's like playing with Play-Doh. And it is delicious and easy, and it's served with a really simple red sauce, and it is an absolute must-have Christmas for us and really a fun, fun thing to do with kids.
How about toasting? What will you toast with this year?
You know, 2013 was one of the best years for Prosecco ever. So I'm sure that there will be a bottle of 2013 on our table. Now, the problem with that is that most Proseccos aren't vintage dated. The better ones are. So if you march into your wine store and ask for a 2013, see what they pull out for you. It's well worth it. And what about you?
Well, my splurge wine is going to be a sparkling wine. It's Schramsberg's Mirabelle Brut Rosé. It's pink. It's bubbly. It's really delicious. And it's around $20 a bottle. But for me, it tastes like bubbly, that's much more expensive. So for a splurge, file that one away.
Nothing better than pink wines.
Yeah, exactly.
Cheers, Lynn. Happy holidays.
Cheers to you, Sally. Now, you can find recipes at splendidtable.org. We have a whole collection of easy holiday dishes. And here's Sally and her pal Patty Hinnich and their Big Appetites podcast at infiniteguest.org. Well, you know what that music means. It is time to play Stump the Cook, our culinary refrigerator game. Now, here's how it works. A listener calls in with five ingredients they actually have in their fridge. And then I need to come up with a dish made from those five ingredients that the caller would actually prepare and eat in real life. USA Weekend has become a partner in this adventure. Now, they're going to take that idea and turn it into a recipe with a photo that you can find monthly in the magazine and online. All right, this week's player is Aaron from San Diego. Hey, Aaron, hi. Welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
So, you want to tell me what you have in your fridge? Five ingredients, right?
Right.
Okay.
I have baby bell mushrooms.
Baby bell mushrooms.
Greek yogurt.
All right. Greek yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Canned cut green beans.
Canned green beans.
Frozen sockeye salmon fillets.
Ooh,
two of them.
Ooh, ooh. Sockeye salmon.
And then I have also frozen what are described on the package as peanut rice balls.
Peanut rice balls.
Yes.
Asian?
Yes.
All right. Do you think they're from Japan? Any idea of their origin?
The writing on it looks Korean.
Okay. All right. Any indication of taste? What it might be? Like, is there chili? Is there soy, you know, beans or something?
Peanut is the second ingredient after rice.
Uh-huh.
And then other than that, there's just shortening, sugar, and water.
Ah, so they may be sweet. Oh, this is interesting. Okay. We have to use the canned green beans, huh? Okay. All right. You like challenging folks, I can tell. Okay. So this is called backpedaling. Ooh, you know, I've got this idea. Okay. I get for free some form of fat, salt, pepper, and water. Okay. And then there are three ingredients I can use that you actually have. Onion.
Yes.
Got onion? Okay. Let's see now. Onion. This is very, very tricky. How about raisins? No raisins?
No raisins.
No raisins. Any other?
Oh, wait. No, I do have raisins.
Oh, you do have raisins. Okay. We want raisins.
Okay.
And lemons. Got any lemons?
No lemons.
No lemons. How about oranges?
No.
No oranges. Boy, am I striking out big time here. How about a tomato?
That I have.
Okay, so those are my three ingredients that you have in your house. All right, so this is what we're going to do. You're going to defrost the salmon.
All right.
Take the mushrooms and the Greek yogurt and the canned green beans that you are going to drain, okay? And you're going to pat dry the beans. You're going to slice up the mushrooms. And you're going to chop up a nice-sized onion. And what you're going to do is the mushrooms and the onion are going to go into a big straight-sided skillet. And in the bottom of that skillet is going to be, ideally, some hot pork fat. If it's from bacon, it's wonderful, but it can be any kind of pork fat. If pork fat is not available, olive oil.
I've got lots of bacon, so.
All right. Okay, so that's my fat of choice. I get that for free. Put that bacon fat in a big straight-sided sauté pan. Heat it up and start sautéing those cut-up mushrooms and a cut-up onion until they're crisp. Now, once they're crisp, you're going to add the raisins, the green beans, and the tomato. And you're going to cook it until everything is soft and delicious. Season it with salt and pepper. Meanwhile, the Greek yogurt is going to get salt and pepper. All right?
All right.
And that's going to be set aside. So that now your stew is utterly lovely with that tomato adding a nice balance. And then you take that, and when you serve it, you're going to top it with the Greek yogurt. Meanwhile, you're going to take those peanut rice balls, put them in a food processor or blender, grind them up until they're very small crumbs. Pack that all around the salmon fillets or steaks, and you've given the salmon a lot of black pepper before you pack it, so you've got some sparkle there.
Okay.
And you're going to put those on a baking sheet, and you're going to slow bake that at about 350 or so until the salmon is just tender and it's crispy on the outside. That goes on the plate. That beautiful braise of the vegetable goes on the plate with that dollop of snow white yogurt. And you've got all of these plays of sweet and savory, all kinds of textures. And that's your dinner. Okay. Would you actually make the dish and eat it?
Yes. I have friends coming over on Friday for dinner, and I'll make it for them then.
That's fabulous. So I win. Oh, I can't believe it. I guess I should thank you for a really tough list of ingredients. Thanks for playing Stump the Cook, Aaron.
Thanks, Lynn.
You take care. Bye.
Bye.
You can find that recipe for roast salmon with crispy peanut rice crumble and tomato raisin chutney at usaweekend.com. And of course, at splendidtable.org. Now, if you want to play Stump the Cook, head to the website and shoot us a note, splendidtable.org. We're going to be back in a minute with your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Christmas time come but once a year. I'm happy, the kids are happy too. Take the next 6 months to pay my bills. Time to think about it, it gives me chills. I don't care, Christmas come but once a year.
We are talking to you this hour. Let's get to your questions. Connect with us at 800-537-5252. You can always get in touch on Facebook and Twitter, and shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. We have Stephanie calling from Lynchburg, Virginia. Stephanie, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I'm actually calling on behalf of my mom. She's hosting a holiday open house at her home for about 50 people on Christmas Eve.
Uh-huh.
She's been hosting and attending kind of similar parties for years, and after a while, the food kind of runs together.
Yeah, it does.
She's looking for some new and interesting appetizer ideas to spice up kind of the usual, I guess, mini quiches and country ham biscuits that usually are kind of the makeup of Southern cocktail parties.
Right. Well, I think, you know, one of the things I love to do is what you call it in Italian, crostini, but really what it is you get some of those long, thin baguettes, you know, the long loaves of bread, and you slice them, about a quarter to a half inch thick. And you can do this days ahead. And you brush them with olive oil, rub them if you want with a little garlic, and sprinkle them with salt, and then put them in about a 300-degree oven. pans and pans of them, and you toast them. And then what you can do is, for instance, one great thing you can do is take a whole collection of mushrooms, brown them in olive oil with a bit of shallot or garlic. And when they really get brown, they'll throw off the liquid. And then when they really start to get crispy and brown, you pour in some port wine and a little cognac.
I love port.
Yeah, and you cook that down a bit, all right? And then if you want to, you could add just a little teeny bit of country bacon, little nubs of it, and toss that in. But the idea is then that is done at room temperature like a pate, and it's piled on top of those crostini. Or you can also do grated cheese that has a lot of character, you know, something like a really aged cheddar, and thin, thin slivers of apples that you've tossed with lemon, and you put that on top. It's a fabulous combination.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah, and if you want to put your country ham on it, it would be fabulous. But one of the things, too, is try sautéing broccoli. Chop it up, stems and all, in butter. Okay, keep it uncovered. Big pan until it's quite soft, and then give it a real shot of lemon. And puree that with Parmesan cheese and have that at room temperature and spread that on top.
Like a broccoli spread.
Like a broccoli spread. It can be so delicious. And top that with some pickled onion.
Right. Okay. And how about something maybe a little heavier? Do you have any ideas for something like that?
Oh, I do heavy very well. Well, you know, I am a bean freak. And I love, I mean, this is, again, a combination of chickpeas and pinto beans, and they can be canned. But what you do first is you drain them, you rinse them, give them a toss of lemon juice, olive oil, salt and pepper, and grated orange rind, all right? And a few hot red pepper flakes. Put them in the fridge overnight, and then puree them. And that's something that people can run cucumber rounds into, zucchini slices into. It's a dip.
Oh, yeah, that would be great with cucumber.
Or a spread. Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, the other great thing is the thing that people love to kid about. You could do a classy cheese ball with dried apricots and candied pecans, and then pick a really sexy cheddar and a bit of sour cream, and you put that all together, and then you can, you know, put it in any shape you want.
I kind of love that. That sounds amazing. Thank you so much.
Well, happy holidays to you and the whole family.
Thank you so much. You as well.
Take care. Rachel is calling from Washington, D.C. Rachel, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about how to make excellent eggnog without alcohol. Every year I do a big batch for a friend's party. Mm-hmm. And last year, some of the kids were kind of upset because they weren't getting a chance to get in on it. And I'd like to give them an opportunity, but I make the Joy of Cooking recipe, and it says, add the alcohol to the egg yolks to dispel the eggy taste.
Oh,
so
poo.
How do you do that without the alcohol?
Oh, that's a bit of nonsense. I'm sorry. first of all, it's called eggnog. No, but this is what you can do. Do you make a custard, essentially, with the eggs and some kind of dairy, and you cook that?
No, I don't cook it. The Joy of Cooking recipe doesn't call for any kind of heat.
All right, here's one thing. This is the food police. Don't do raw eggs. They can be tricky. You know, the salmonella thing? And it doesn't matter if they're organic or they're free range. So what you can do, look anywhere you want, on our website, anywhere on the web, in cookbooks, you want to do a custard. Sometimes it's called in French crème anglaise. And the general formula is 4 egg yolks to 2 to 3 cups of milk, half and half, or cream. And you can even dilute it more. But that's sort of the foundation. And you'll see in the recipe, what it has you do is heat the liquid first. And that's done with some sugar. Usually it's about a half a cup of sugar for every, let's say, 4 eggs. Or you could do a little less and add more as you go along. But the idea here is that you want to beat up the egg yolks in one bowl in a pan. You're going to warm up the milk. You don't want to boil it, but just warm up the milk or whatever dairy product you're using. And then very slowly let that get beaten with a whisk into the egg yolks so that you don't curdle them. Mm-hmm. Okay? And then gradually off the heat, you pour that back in and you make a custard. So you now have a custard. You can add vanilla to it, and nutmeg and cinnamon and whatever. But this is where the fun begins. Now you add the cream and the sour cream, which I love in eggnog. And if you want to, the half and half. And if you want, you can add a little something like a rum flavoring, but nothing that's going to be alcohol. And that's an eggnog right there.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah, I've made more work for you. I'm sorry, but...
Well, it'll be worth it, I'm assuming.
Yes, it will be. And if you use a fresh vanilla bean, you know, a fresh grated nutmeg...
Sounds fabulous.
Okay, happy holidays.
Thank you so much.
You take care, Rachel.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
800-537-5252. That's one way to reach us. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Liz Ann is calling from Chicago. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You did. No one ever does, but you did, yes.
I can't. A lucky moment. So what do you want to talk about?
Well, thanks for your show. I love it.
Thank you.
Really, very, very much. I'm a vegetarian. So are my 20-year-old daughters. I have twins. And on Christmas Day, we have a variety of people come to our house for dinner. It can be from 8 people to maybe even 18, depending on who's in town, who doesn't have a place to go, whatever.
Right.
I like to make as much as I can homemade. And I've made like a bechamel spinach lasagna and then ordered a meat lasagna from a restaurant. But I wanted to pick your brain and see if you had an idea for something lovely to be a Christmas dish for people that are vegetarian and non-vegetarian. I make homemade baguette, and I have a 100-year-old gingerbread cake recipe that I serve as dessert. Those are things that have to stay because people love them. And
that sounds
happy.
Wonderful. That sounds absolutely wonderful. Well, you know, one of the things that's kind of great to do, and do you eat fish?
I eat fish. My kids don't.
Okay. Because one thing, it's very celebratory. It tends to be pricey. But it's one of those things that sort of says celebration is a whole side of smoked salmon.
Mm.
And you can have with it diced onion, red onion that you've sprinkled with just a little bit of lemon juice so it's not super strong, wedges of lemon, crackers, or I love rounds of cucumber. And you could have, there's a sweet dill mustard sauce done in Scandinavia where it's a lot of mustard and a bit of oil and brown sugar to taste and salt and then tons of fresh dill. And that can be drizzled, you know, when you serve yourself.
That's a great idea.
And another thing, I've mentioned this every year I talk about this. There is something so grand about a big hunk of good cheese. And my all-time favorite for that kind of thing is either Parmigiano Reggiano, which will break the bank, or a hunk of good cheddar. Some people love to do a blue cheese, but the idea is it's something that's a sizable chunk. People can, you know, chunk off what they want. You could have all different kinds of dried fruits around it that people can nibble with the cheese, or they could put the cheese on a cracker or whatever. And then if you wanted to, one thing that you could do is, I love the idea of baked pastas because they're so forgiving and they can be really, really delicious. But it doesn't have to be lasagna, by the way. It could be any wide noodle. You could do something like fettuccine.
Ooh,
or tagliatelle. Right. But here's the idea. You make a really nice, simple, light tomato sauce. You know, sautéed onions, garlic, a lot of basil. You throw in the tomatoes and you cook them briefly until they're thickened a bit. And you do it in a big skillet and you do this days ahead. Freeze it if you want. Then what you do in a separate pan is you take dried porcini, you soak them, and then you save that liquid, you strain the liquid, and you take a ton of fresh mushrooms as well that you slice, and you saute that in olive oil with a little bit of butter. And then what you add to that is a little bit of marsala once it's all browned up and a bit of red wine. You have some garlic in there. You could have some fresh oregano or fresh rosemary, which is so good with that. And you cook down all that alcohol until it's luscious, a teeny bit of cream. And now what you do is, if you're doing lasagna, you do layers of grated Parmigiano, tomato, mushrooms, pasta. If you're doing the fettuccine route, you toss everything together. And then you sprinkle cheese over the top. You cover it with foil, take it out of the fridge an hour and a half before you're going to slow bake it. Bake it about an hour to make sure it's really bubbly all the way through, and people will adore it. Now, if you wanted to add meat, you could, but there's no meat, and no one is going to miss it because it's such a plush dish.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
It's not a bad thing.
I think you planned my Christmas dinner for me. Thank you.
Oh, have a great holiday.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, splendidtable.org, or actually call us, 800-537-5252. Olive oil is just like wine. There are good years and there are not so good years. Well, Sally Swift, our producer, is checking in about the 2014 harvest with Russ Parsons. He's food editor and columnist at the LA Times.
Hey, Russ. Nice to talk to you.
Oh, it's wonderful to speak with you again.
So what's the word on the 2014 olive oil harvest?
Oh, it's just, I mean, the word is really, really bad. The world output of olive oil is supposed to be down 20% this year.
Wow.
And when you're talking about a staple crop like that, that's just a massive amount. And what's even worse is that the places that have the best olive oil seem to be among those that are the hardest hit. Tuscany and Umbria have just been absolutely devastated. The Italian newspaper La Repubblica is calling it the black year for Italian olive oil.
Oh, man. Okay, so what's behind that?
Well, there are a couple of factors that are behind it. The first, of course, is the weather was just awful. And it was awful at all of the most important times. And so when the trees were going from flower to fruit, the temperature, which had been freezing, all of a sudden shot up, causing it to drop a lot of fruit. It was a really hot and humid summer with lots and lots of rain. And then in September, what olives had been able to survive were just getting ready to ripen. They had massive, massive hailstorms. They had two of them that lasted for more than an hour that just, you know, knocked everything else off the tree. And on top of that, when you've got really hot, humid weather, that's when you get lots of pest problems. And Italy has been hit pretty hard by I guess you could call it a kind of a fruit fly that especially loves olives. And it lays its eggs in the olive so that the olive looks almost normal until it's ripe and it's picked, and you find out that the eggs have been eating on the olive, and it just completely spoils the fruit. So wow. There are important producers like Capizzana and who simply are refusing to make any olive oil at all this year.
And so what's going on in the rest of Europe? Is it as bad in Spain?
Well, Spain is down by half because of the same kind of weather problems. That's a little bit – Spain's the world's largest olive oil producer, and that's a little bit misleading because Spain was way, way up last year. They had like this humongous record harvest. Greece is supposed to be doing okay, which is really good news. And there are places in Italy that are doing better than others. Supposedly, in the southern part of Italy, Puglia and Sicily were not quite as hard hit. And also, olive groves that are at higher altitude in Tuscany and Umbria were not as hard hit. So there will be some oil, some of that good oil coming in, but not nearly as much as in the past. And, of course, it's going to be really expensive.
Right.
And it's really important that people learn to shop for oil and shop carefully.
Yeah, so what should we be looking for when we're buying this harvest?
Well, the thing with olive oil is that it's a slippery business. And I have to say, you know, I remember doing this story, a story very similar to this, in 1985. And there had been a huge freeze which had devastated the olive groves in Tuscany. And I had interviewed everybody that I could find, and everyone assured me that there would be almost no production of Tuscan olive oil that year. And so I wrote the story with great confidence. And then when I looked at the statistics a year later, actually exports of Tuscan olive oil had increased.
How did that happen?
Because there's a wrinkle in Italian labeling law that says that you can label olive oil according to where it's bottled, not according to where it was grown.
Oh, so you could be buying olives from somewhere else and pressing them in Tuscany and selling them as Tuscan oil.
Exactly. And imports of olive oil in Italy are already up 45%. So you can see there's going to be a lot of that stuff going on. There are a couple things that you can do. Mm-hmm. One of them is read the label carefully. If it says produced and bottled by, that's an indication that the oil in there came from that actual estate. And also, the more careful olive oil producers and the ones who are going to be more reliable also will vintage date their oils now so that you're sure that you're getting fresh oil. Failing that, A lot of people are recommending that you just stock up on the 2013 oils that are already here. Make sure that you keep them in a cool, dark place.
And yeah, because we're at the end of their good use date.
Right.
It sounds like Greek oil would be pretty safe.
Well, the Greek oils are supposed to be good, and I'll also put in a plug for California oils.
Mm-hmm.
You know, California oil production has really, really improved over the last 5 years, and they have very, very stringent controls. Now, you know, there's some debate about whether everything that is being produced meets those controls, but, you know, a place like California Olive Ranch, that's my house oil, and they do just a terrific job mm-hmm. at a remarkably fair price.
Okay, that's great. We've got some shopping tips. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Sally.
Russ Parsons is author of How to Pick a Peach, still one of the best books around on working with produce. Well, that's it for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, Happy Kwanzaa. And let me leave you with this thought from Anonymous, who said, I once wanted to become an atheist, but I gave it up. They have no holidays. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. This month, we're doing something important here at the Splendid Table. We're partnering with Feeding America to bring assistance to people who are hungry. Hunger happens in every community, rural or urban, and has an effect on all of us. When you support the Splendid Table this holiday season, your gift will not only help us produce our program, but it will help provide meals to people in need through Feeding America's network of member food banks. In these months of feasting and celebration for many of us, let's remember those who are going without. Visit SplendidTable.org to get more information on our partnership with Feeding America, as well as information on anything else you heard here today. And if you want to catch up on our show on your own schedule, download our podcasts. Find them at InfiniteGuests.org. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great holiday. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.